This is the download of Sport and the British from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Sport and the British is presented by Claire Balding.
It's been centuries since Scotland fought England on a battlefield, but the conflict has continued, forged at the furnace of football. This is the story of how Scottish football has been shaped and defined by Scotland's national identity and its relationship with England.
Sport and the British. Anyone but England.
That is the Hampden roar. And I'm standing here in the VIP area at Hampden Park, the area that traditionally would be for Celtic fans is to my right, which is the east side of the ground, and Rangers fans always sit to the left, which is the west side of the ground. Together they come to make this incredible cacophony of sound, and you can hear from my voice echoing around how the stadium helps, because it contains and amplifies the sound. And if you get swirling winds in here as well, just moving that sound around, it becomes like a wave of noise. Numbers really help, obviously, and they did. In 1937, an official attendance here was recorded of 149,415. That was a world record at the time, and it still is a European record, but people who were there reckon it could have been up to 180,000 people. And what's it like to play with that sound behind you or indeed against you? An England player, Tommy Lawton, once said,
"I thought to myself, what a noise. That was when I could think. The noise echoes and eddies around this giant bowl and smashes into your eardrums."
This was one of Scotland's most potent and intimidating weapons, a war cry against the old enemy. Never was it louder or more heartfelt than when Scotland played England, which they did almost every year from 1872 to 1989. For a century, the England-Scotland game was the biggest sporting event in Britain. Looming large in Scottish football folklore is the story of the match against England at Wembley on March the 31st, 1928. 8,000 Scottish fans made the trip to Wembley, despite England being the hot favourites. English supporters never made the reverse trip in the same numbers. Scottish captain Jimmy McMullen gave a short and simple tactical talk the night before the match. "Go to bed and pray for rain." Author and journalist Hugh McIlvany is one of the most respected voices on football.
The Scots, very early in the development of football in any organised way in the country, played with a lot of emphasis on passing and craft. That was quite natural because we're not a race of giant athletes. And also, a lot of the early football emanated from urban environments, from cramped conditions of living, and was played by people who weren't particularly well-nourished. So they were small. For instance, when Scotland had one of the most famous victories, perhaps an overemphasized victory, against England at Wembley in 1928, when the Wembley Wizards became immortal in the folklore of the game north of the border, the tallest man in the forward line was Alec Jackson on the right wing at 5'7". You know, if they'd been any shorter, Snow White might have got a job as the coach.
There's a light drizzle here in Glasgow today, but the night before that 1928 match, Scottish prayers for rain were answered. The heavens opened and the lush Wembley turf turned into a slippery mud bath. In those conditions, it was an advantage to be small, to be nippy and agile rather than big and strong. Scotland ran rings round England's heavy-footed defenders. Here at Hampden, they have the Scottish Museum of Football, and I'm surrounded now by photographs and tributes to great players from the past. And in a glass cabinet, that victory of 1928 is commemorated. The ball is here, signed by all the players, and it says Scotland 5, England 1. According to the Times, Scotland could have got more if they hadn't enjoyed the pleasure of playing with the mouse rather than killing it. The streets of London rang with Scottish songs that night, and according to the Glasgow Herald, Londoners sportingly joined in the singing. England wanted to forget that match as soon as they could. For Scotland, they will never forget it. And football here has always been more than just a game. Hugh McIlvany again.
The match with England has particular importance. It's just a coincidence that in the Collins Encyclopedia of Scotland, football and Flodden are only a couple of entries apart.
The Scottish players gained a reputation for playing a more skillful style of football and they became hot property. There grew up a long tradition of excellent players moving to wealthier clubs in England. They were known as the Scotch Professors, and it explains here in this cabinet that the clever passing and running game which they played was regarded as scientific. In 1882, Bolton Wanderers were given the nickname the Caledonians because they had six Scots on their books. And the Liverpool team of the 1890s were known as the team of Max. But there remained a niggling suspicion of players who spent their career outside Scotland. And if you come round this corner, there's a black and white photo of Dennis Law. And you can see from the faces of the spectators that they are shouting abuse at him. This is not a kind photograph. Now, Dennis Law still has the joint record for goals scored for Scotland, 30 goals in 55 appearances. But he never played for a club in Scotland. And after the humiliating 9-3 defeat by England in 1961, the blame was laid at the door of the Anglos, as they called them, the players who were based in England. Now, Law may have been pragmatic in his approach to his professional career, but he remained a true Scot, coming home so that his son was born on Scottish soil, and famously playing golf rather than watching England in the World Cup final of 1966.
As we came round the corner from the 18th green, a crowd of members were at the clubhouse, cheering and waiting to tell me that England had won the World Cup. It was the blackest day of my life.
In 1977, an estimated 80,000 Scottish supporters travelled to London for the annual match against England. Now, this coincided with the weekend celebrations of the Queen's Silver Jubilee. A dramatic Scotland victory prompted visiting fans to invade the pitch. They broke the goalposts, they dug up sections of the Wembley turf, and the English press angrily condemned the drunken hooliganism of the Scottish hordes.
A lot of Scots have attached too much importance to football for a start, and certainly to the England-Scotland game. But it's natural in a way that if you've got a big neighbour, you're going to have the minority race sense of defiance. And the Scots have always taken great pride, particularly because they not only had a sporting rivalry, they had a sort of political resentment of England. I remember going to a match at Hampden, and the chant on the train wasn't about football. It was, if you hate Margaret Thatcher, clap your hands.
Scotland qualified for the World Cup in Argentina in 1978. England, Wales and Northern Ireland were all knocked out. Expectations were high, fired up by the Scotland manager, Ali McLeod.
I think a medal of some sort will come, and I pray and hope that it's the gold one. Space is in the wardrobe for it to be put there.
But Argentina was a flop. Scotland didn't even get out of the group stage.
I think the lunacy reached its zenith when Ali McLeod was the national team manager and took the team to Argentina. And Ali was talking about winning it, which was madness. Well, I thought a lot of people whose energy would have been better directed politically or perhaps towards their own education saw the game as a plank of their identity. I mean, it was possible to go into a factory and say, you know, is big Jimmy Thompson about here? And they say, Jimmy Thompson? He said, Jimmy Thompson, the Rangers supporter. Oh, yeah, he's along there. And it worried me a lot, that, when I was younger.
Football played its part in the move towards Scottish independence, according to the curator here at Hampden, Richard McBrearty.
In the backdrop of the 1978 World Cup, Scotland were voting the following year for devolution, and there was real optimism that Scotland would vote for devolution and it would be delivered. But what's interesting about it, some people actually still quite strongly believe that the disaster, dare I say, that was Argentina, strongly affected the Scottish psyche. That many people believe that it actually affected the voting the following year when it came to devolution. That many people lost that confidence, that self-belief, and ultimately the vote for devolution didn't meet the threshold, I think the 40% threshold that was required, and so devolution would have to wait virtually a generation.
There are various reasons why football in Scotland does not enjoy the same prominence as it used to and why it's not as successful. And it's partly to do with funding, it's partly to do with children having other escape routes. If football was their way out, they've now got lots of other ways that they can get out. But it is slightly ironic that since Scotland qualified for France 98 for the World Cup, the year after the Scottish Parliament opened, they haven't since then qualified for a World or European Cup. So has football slipped from its ledge? It could be argued that political devolution has blunted Scotland's hunger for winning on a world stage, and the lack of the England-Scotland matches has taken away its fiercest rival. Hugh McIlvany recognises that although Scotland no longer produces the players it once did, its influence is still very much felt throughout English football.
We used to have droves of players in the big English clubs. You know, you'd find five or six key players in the England teams, even as recently as the great Liverpool team when you had Hansen and Souness and Dalglish. But as we deteriorated as performers on the park, we never lost the understanding of the game or the capacity to tell people how it might be best played. And that's why we've got, I think, per capita, the greatest record of producing managers in the whole of football. When you think of Matt Busby, Bill Shankly, Jock Stein, Alec Ferguson, I think the record there is quite exceptional.
During the 80s, the great England-Scotland rivalry started to decline, and in 1989, the last of the regular England-Scotland matches was played. England suddenly had new, bigger enemies like Germany and Argentina. When some Scottish newspapers encouraged their readers to get behind England in the 1998 World Cup once Scotland had been eliminated, it didn't catch on. In fact, it was a ridiculous idea. And when Britain's number one tennis player, Andy Murray, was asked who he'd be supporting at the World Cup recently, he said, "Whoever's playing England." He was joking, but it is still unthinkable for a Scotsman to support England. It is still the larger, wealthier rival that sucked the most talented people southward and claimed glory on the back of them. T-shirts with the slogan, "Anyone but England," still sell well here in Scotland.
Thank you for downloading Sport and the British from the BBC.